In this episode, you get to hear from Dr. Adam Link. Adam is a certified financial planner. He comes from the tech and finance spaces, and he wrote a book called Why Real Estate Sucks. We're going to get into that. He's lost over $800,000 in real estate syndications, and he really has a wealth of knowledge. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I think you're going to as well. You know, you should listen to this episode and learn from his lessons that he's learned, learn from his mistakes. I certainly chime in on some things as well. And I just love that, you know, we talk about a good bit about the seasons in life, how life has seasons. There's not one path to success. He's gone back and forth between being a W-2 employee and being an entrepreneur. He's got a lot of financial abundance for sure, multimillionaire. But he's got scars to prove it, and the journey is not over. And you know, I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. There's a lot of inspiration, but also a lot of practical guidance and a lot of value overall. Enjoy.
From adversity to abundance, hosted by entrepreneur and seasoned real estate investor Jamie Bateman, is the ultimate guide for active and passive investors seeking clarity, mental fitness, and the confidence to make inspired decisions in the world of real estate. With a decade plus of investing experience across various niches and a background as a combat veteran, former Army officer, and multi-million dollar mortgage note company owner, Jamie brings a wealth of knowledge and inspiring stories to each episode. Through weekly episodes featuring insightful interviews with industry leaders and solo explorations of mindset and strategy, listeners will uncover actionable advice and tips to overcome challenges and build lasting financial success. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting, From Adversity to Abundance is your roadmap to turning obstacles into opportunities and achieving financial freedom.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast. I am your host, Jamie Bateman, and today we have with us Dr. Adam Link. Adam is a certified financial planner, correct me if I'm wrong, Adam, and has a lot of investing experience in many different asset classes and some potentially controversial opinions. We'll see where the episode goes. Adam, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Yeah, as we record this on a Friday morning here, you know, I got my cup of coffee with me and ready to chat money, chat investments, and chat investing. I love it.
Absolutely. Me too. I'm excited. This is going to be good. For the listener who may not be familiar with you, Adam, who are you and what are you up to today? And what is some of the abundance that you can touch on, the abundance that you've been able to experience possibly financially that you're living in today?
Yeah, certainly. Happy to. So my name is Dr. Adam Link. As the doctor implies, I have a doctorate. So I learned best through formal education. So I got my doctorate in computer science, and I'm a certified financial planner, which means I help individuals to craft a plan to use their money to achieve the goals that they want. Specifically, I typically work with tech folks and folks who are kind of up and coming on their wealth journey. I look for people who kind of look like I was maybe 10 years ago, hungry, wanting to be a millionaire, wanting to, you know, accumulate capital. And that's usually who I enjoy working with because I know that path, right? I've lived that path and I'm kind of on the other side of that path now where, you know, I can say things like the first million you make is the hardest million you'll make. And then the second million is easier. And the third million is even easier. And we can keep going, right? But, you know, once you end up in that realm where you don't need to necessarily look at a receipt from a store pretty much ever again, right? It's a really cool place to be. And one of the things that I've really enjoyed in my life is helping other people get to that place where I am, where, you know, you don't have to worry about the day to day. You know, most Americans are worried about a $400 unexpected expense. And I don't even know if a $400 expense would register for me. Right. You know, and that's to say, you know, I've worked incredibly hard. I've gotten somewhat lucky, been in the right place at the right time many times, you know, but really hustled a lot to get to where I am. And now it's a question of, well, where do I want to go from here? How many more zeros do I want to add after the net worth? And that's a really fun place to be, right? When you've reached your goal and it's just a question of, well, how big do I want to get? Right.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that's, you talk about abundance, man. I don't know. I feel like I've got a pretty good life. I've got a big, well, biggish house on a lake. I've got a boat,
Nice.
all the trappings of somebody who's been materially successful, right?
Got it. Yeah, and then it's just been smooth sailing and easy for you your entire life, right?
100%. Never had any. No, I'm totally kidding, man. Yeah, there were nights where I stayed awake till 3 in the morning, worried about, the next day, worried about meetings, mental breakdowns, you name it, right? Like we all face it.
So for the listener, just, I mean, we do try to provide a bit of a hook, just being honest with people in the beginning of an episode to point out some of the abundance that the guest, in this case, Dr. Adam Link, is experiencing. But the reality is, it's not easy to get there typically. And even if you were handed $5 million, you've likely had some type of adversity along the way. So, but we're trying to provide inspiration as well as practical value. So let's dive back into your backstory, Adam. I think before we hit record, you mentioned to me that right after college, you started to experience some adversity. Why don't you talk about that for us?
Yeah, certainly. So in college, I got my degree in finance. I then kind of throughout my career ended up switching between tech and finance. So my story is really one of pursuing two paths simultaneously as often as I could. Coming out of college, I basically job hopped. I came out in 2010. So we were kind of on the back of the Great Financial Crisis. Blocks of houses were going for $100 in Detroit. I didn't have $100 to my name, or I would have bought, blocks of houses. So I basically came out, of college deciding between $8 hamburger or $9 cheeseburger. Did I have an extra dollar in my bank account at that point in time? And really took whatever job I could get. I ended up working hourly, for a financial advisor, and then switched over and worked in financial services for a while. Left that job because I wanted to start up a company, because like everyone else, being an entrepreneur is the way to insane wealth. And so started up a company, and that went nowhere, and then got another job and started, right? So like, just kind of switched around, where enough that my grandfather asked my dad at one point, is Adam ever going to hold down an actual job? Right? And like, you got to understand, my grandfather was a CEO of a pretty large company, right? So like, he was the CEO of Hardware Hank. So he had success in his own life, and he's like, is this guy, is he ever going to do something with his life? Well, luckily, the answer is yes. I basically ended up getting one of the startups that I was working on, with my college roommate to succeed. We ended up selling that to a company that wanted to build a mobile application kind of studio. And so, we were at the table for our first sale. And it wasn't a big one, but it was enough that, we got to the table, we got to negotiate. We met a guy who actually was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So I had kind of my first brush with insane wealth, right? And really got a chance to work alongside that individual and his company for a number of years as I kind of learned what the tech industry was. And, then started up another company. Sold that one. So second time at the table, right? Again, not a huge exit, bigger than the previous one, but getting to the table a couple times as an entrepreneur means you at least know what a term sheet looks like. And then from there, really ended up working in the crypto space. This is kind of about 8, 9 years ago now, when I entered the crypto space. And it was, early on in crypto, 2017, 2016. I ended up being hired as employee number one for a startup company. And that was kind of the third time I got to the table when we sold that company. And then that led me to working at Coinbase, where I was a part of the IPO at Coinbase, and then leaving Coinbase to start Fireweed Capital, because I basically realized all along that time when I was doing tech, I was also giving financial advice to all my coworkers. Like,
right.
Here's how you do 401k investing. Here's how you should
Right.
think about, you know, buying houses. And I was like, I should get paid for that. So I decided to go become a licensed financial advisor, go back to kind of my first love of finance. And that's what I'm doing now.
Nice. Yeah. I love the fact that, you know, one of the things I tend to point out, you know, in different episodes is that there's not one path to financial freedom. There's not one, you know, way to do this whole investing or financial planning thing. And we definitely don't, I don't view it as, oh, you should be an employee for 15 years and then you should quit your W-2 and become an entrepreneur. And, you know, I like to talk about life having seasons, and yeah, you can have an idea of where you're headed, and you should have some goals and some, you know, something you're trying to aspire to do and be, but things change and your passions change and market conditions change, and you got to work with the circumstances around you, and there's nothing wrong with a pivot. So sounds like you've had numerous pivots over the years.
Oh yeah.
And a lot of different seasons in your life, and it hasn't been a straight line to success. And I also love just the tech real estate crossover, because I think that's obviously a big thing right now for sure. And then the personal finance angle has always appealed to me as well. So I guess looking back at your career, what would you say were some of the inflection points, the biggest, you mentioned coming, getting to the table three times, and those were three big successes. Would you say those were kind of the big inflection points from a success standpoint, or were there others along the way?
Yeah. So I think everything that you do in life is kind of, you know, training for the next thing. Right. And so getting to the table once, you know, kind of, it meant the second time I was at the table selling a company. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, I'm selling a company. It was like, okay, this is like, I've been here before. It's slightly different, but the coolness factor has worn off. And so you're able to just deal a little bit less emotionally.
Sure.
Right. And so every time you do something, you know, the next time you do it, it's a little bit less emotional, a little bit more logical.
Makes sense.
What I would say when I think about kind of inflection points, one of the things I did early on that I think was really helpful was make outrageous demands for salary. I went through a period in my life over about 6 years where every 2 years or so I doubled my salary.
Wow.
Now, yeah. Which tells me I was probably underpaid.
Underpaid initially, yeah.
Yeah, for some of that. But
right.
You know, I basically, through asking outrageous demands and job hopping, you know, every time someone asked, well, what's the salary you want? I would say double the previous salary. And the crazy thing is I hit enough yeses that I was able to land that. Now, that's not to say like I had three interviews and I doubled my salary each time. Like, no, I said that a lot of times and got a lot of no's and a lot of thought, no, that's not possible.
Right.
And right. But all you need is one yes.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you go from, you know, a life where you think $50,000 a year is a ton of money to a life where you're making over $100,000.
Yeah.
Well over 100,000. Right. And like, that's just a fundamentally different place to be. And now you've got a high watermark that when you go to your next job, right, they're like, oh, well, we'll pay you this. You're like, okay, well, no, my base salary is, you know, 200,000. My base salary is 300,000. There was one point after Coinbase's IPO that a recruiter tried to hire me away. And I basically said, okay, here's my comp package. Can you match it? And the guy looked at it and he goes, there is no way anyone in the industry can match this comp package. And I was like, well, then I guess I'm not for, yeah, I guess you're not hiring me, right?
Right.
And it was just, you know, like, yeah, well, here's a giant number, right? And the reality is that giant number is real for a lot of people in tech. You know, you hear about these $10, $20 million packages that folks in AI are getting. Like, that comes from somewhere.
Yeah.
Right. And it does happen to somebody. Right?
Sure. Now, we focused a good bit on your successes thus far, intentionally. But I know you've lost money with different investments along the way, and a good bit of money. So let's talk about really some of that financial adversity with specific investment choices and maybe some things you would do differently. I know you wrote a book. A couple of books, one of which is entitled, I think it's Why Real Estate Sucks. Is that right?
That is correct.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that book, and let's talk about why you wrote that book. I'm a real estate investor. We do single family residential. We buy mortgage notes. I also have some rental properties. I'm a big residential real estate, not huge, but I'm a fan of residential real estate investing in general where it fits. But what are some of the losses you've experienced in real estate or other asset classes?
Yeah, I'm certainly happy to talk about that. So the book, Why Real Estate Sucks, is really based on my own personal experiences in real estate. And of course, the book is called Why Real Estate Sucks. So I don't include the ones where like the deal went well, obviously, right?
Right.
Because what I want to do is I really wanted to highlight what actually happens in real estate, both the good and the bad. I don't know if you guys will have a video for this or not, but behind me, I've got a whole bunch of books. And there's a whole section of my books over here, which is basically how to invest in real estate. I've got the Bigger Pockets books, I got the Grant Cardone books, I've got like all the major books. I followed all the people on Facebook. I got pretty deep into real estate. I'd say this was about 4 years ago. And like many people probably listening, thought, okay, well, real estate's the way to become a millionaire and have passive income and just kind of fundamentally change my life. So I started out with this goal of I wanted to be at 6,000 doors by the age of 40. Which is a huge goal, right? And I don't do anything small, right? Because if
Yeah,
you're
it
going to
didn't
do
sound
something,
like it.
go big. And so I started acquiring doors, and I started basically as an LP on a couple deals, and then working my way up to eventually being a GP and a KP on a deal. So I had a couple hundred doors under
And
management.
just quickly, for the for those who may not be familiar, LP is limited partner, GP is a general partner where you're running the show, basically you're the operator, right? LP is you're a passive investor, and KP, that's a key principal or key partner where you're basically they're kind of borrowing your name in a sense. Or tell me what that is.
So it's kind of the progression that you end up doing. So a limited partner is, here's my money. I'm just along for the ride. Let's see what happens. General partner is, I have an equity stake in the deal that I've either bought or I've earned. And in some way, shape, or form, I am controlling a part of the deal, right? I'm responsible. I'm somewhere in management. And a KP or key partner is somebody who signs on the loan. So you are pledging your assets against the debt that is being taken out to purchase this real estate. And so a key partner is really where I'd say the big dogs play, right? These are the guys with money, right? You got to have money and you got to have experience to be a KP. You need one or the other. So I brought the money, not the experience. I had a
Got
guy
it.
that brought the experience. And then, I held on for 2 years as a key partner, and now most banks would take me as a key partner signing solo, because I have 2 years of operating experience, right?
Got
So
it.
that's kind of,
Yeah, that's a great overview.
I punched my key partner card. That is a big thing in the real estate. If you're going to go into real estate syndications, you want to be able to say, yeah, I can also be a KP. I can sign on the debt.
Absolutely. Okay. That was a good overview. Thank you. So, where did things go wrong for you?
Yeah, well, let's talk about one deal, which I'm not going to say the individual I invested with, for multiple reasons. One being they're currently under FBI investigation, which tells you how that deal landed. But there's a lot of fraud and a lot of people out there who are willing to take your money and do very unscrupulous things with
It's unbelievable. I
it.
just absolutely. Go ahead.
If you know real estate, I mean, numbers like 15% returns, 18% IRR, these numbers are not ridiculous. When you look at the stock market, an 18% return in the stock market is a very, very good year, right? Whereas, 18% is kind of par for the course in real estate. So early on in my real estate investing career, I basically got to know an individual who was raising money for a real estate fund. And had a side deal, and basically the side deal was, look, you give me 50 grand, I'll give you back 10% returns after a year. And I thought, okay, well, 10% return in real estate is not ridiculous, right? It's right in line with a senior debt position on, right? And looking at the deal terms, it was basically, look, if I don't pay you, it was kind of a double collateral backed note. It was, okay, well, here's what I'm buying, right? And if this doesn't, work out, here's a stake in another building that I'd give you. And if that doesn't work out, here's a stake in my fund. And I was like, okay, well, look, I've got a pretty good fallback position here, right? If this guy doesn't pay me, like, I can probably go after his assets. And if nothing else, I roll it over to an equity stake in his fund. Well, this guy didn't pay me. You know, basically the due date for the note came and went. And we, you know, every time I'd contact him, it was the same thing. You know, hey, payment's coming. Hey, had a problem with refinancing a property. Hey, you know, all these excuses.
Right. So
after about 90 days, I basically said, okay, well, I'm pretty sure he's got my money. He's not.
Right.
And it took me a little bit, you know, just kind of trying to collect the debt. And I got a paper trail. And then I talked to my CPA and I said, look, I'm not getting this money back. Let's write off the investment.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, $50,000 out the window. That's done. It's an expensive lesson to learn.
Mm-hmm.
This individual defrauded people for over $4 million.
Wow.
Is going through bankruptcy and is under investigation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there is a long arc of karma in the universe, but, you know, that was kind of one of the things that you just go in there and you go, okay, well, it's $50,000 I'm never going to see again. And that, you know, it sucked. I went back and looked at the decks and looked at the documents and tried to figure out, you know, were there signs that I missed?
Right.
And, you know, honestly, more due diligence may have turned up something. But
yeah.
Man, that deal, it just seemed so reasonable.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. No, I hear what you're saying. It's, I mean, we're not going to make this an episode about me and, but, it's very easy to beat yourself up after the fact for sure, you know, and say, well, here's something I should have caught. It's like, well, but it made sense at the time. I mean, and you know, I'll just speak for myself. Yes. There are deals where I should have done a better job evaluating the person I invested with. That's typically number one, you know, or the deal itself. And or, but the reality is, you know, you can do everything right from a due diligence standpoint and the deal can go way wrong. And, you know, fraud is a whole separate, I mean, that's, you know, difficult to spot. I mean, before it occurs. Right. So, I've been the victim of a pretty big PPP loan fraud, scheme. And in fact, it's years later now, but it's being prosecuted. There was a huge 10 person, you know, collaborative scheme going on. And I had to, you know, I got letters from the IRS saying I owed $105,000 because I'd, apparently had 12 employees that I, you know, with, you know, and I'd taken out a $90-some thousand PPP loan. None of this was true at all. And someone had, you know, stolen my identity and gotten a PPP loan, you know, wired the day after the application was submitted. They didn't look anything like me. They opened up a fake bank account and I had to close a business, move some rentals over to the new business. It was a lot of stress and financially there wasn't a huge loss to me personally. It's actually the US taxpayer who was ripped off. But I've experienced some of the things you're talking about, and it's like, I don't know what did I do it? Would I do things differently? I mean, I could have been a little more proactive in certain ways, but I really don't feel like I did anything majorly wrong in that case. I just was in the wrong place at the wrong time. So again, not trying to make it an episode about me. I can just relate in some ways. And you know, there's a lot, real estate in general is fairly unregulated real estate investing. I mean, when you get into funds and things, there's the SEC and certain state regulators and whatnot, but there's a lot of the wild, wild west going on out there, especially in, we do mortgage notes. And I mean, you know, it's a pretty low barrier to entry in our space and, you know, which can be a good thing because people can jump in and do well and make money. But it invites a lot of unscrupulous people. And so we try to kind of police our own in our industry, because there's a lot of fraud out there and a lot of people, I just don't know how people can sleep at night after doing what they do. Some of these people, most people, I don't think are that way, but, anyway, so what happened in your case?
Yeah. So, I mean, in this case, you know, I ended up writing off the investment. Which I will say, as you gain wealth, the team you have around you is incredibly important, Obviously, I'm a financial advisor,
Absolutely.
so I think you should have a financial advisor. I will also tell you, if you're going off the beaten path, get a really good CPA. You know, like the number of
Sure.
times my CPA has saved my butt because he looked at, you know, a deal a slightly different way, and he goes, "Oh, well, actually, you got this capital gain over here. You write off that capital loss, you net them together, and there you go." Right? And it's like,
Sure.
okay, cool. You know, I
Right.
so a good CPA who knows the tax code can really help you out when, you know, when you have these financial losses, because the thing is, you know, the government wants people to take risk, right? The
Right.
government tax code is written for the business owner, for the entrepreneur, and
True.
there's risk and you lose money. And the government basically recognizes
Yeah.
if you lose money that you know, they should do something nice for you, right? And so
Right.
there's a lot of incentives for when you do have a deal go south that you can really capture that and bring it forward to offset future wins. So that's actually, you know, we'll talk about the second
Yeah.
big misadventure, which was
Yeah.
the being a GP and a KP on
Okay.
a deal. It was about a $3 million deal, and I will say everything seemed to look good on paper, right? And this is how deals often are, right? It looks good on paper. And I will say I had a great group of investors on this one. We were basically, I should say, partners on this one. We set it up as a joint venture, with the
Okay.
idea basically being that we were all going to try to learn what we could by purchasing a larger property. And
Okay.
the goal was really to help get some of us to become key partners and then, you know, learn operations, right? And where the deal basically ended up falling apart was the market shifted on us. Rents were not able to increase as much as we thought.
This is a multifamily syndication, I
Yep,
presume.
multifamily syndication.
Yeah.
Yep. And we did not have a property manager that was going to work with the deal structure we had put together.
Okay.
So we ended up going through two property managers in the span of, you know, a couple of years, which is a fairly, I'd say, high churn, but also not abnormal, right? There's a lot of deals you get in where the first property manager's out after about the first year because it's just not a fit. Right. I've seen deals like that as an LP, and you just go, okay, well, whatever. Right. Like, I get it.
Right.
You're bringing in some new people.
Right. It's not a huge red flag that there's something wrong with the deal. I agree. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Where we ended up getting kind of screwed over on the deal by the property manager was they actually negotiated better on the contract.
Okay.
Yep. And they, you know, slipped in a common clause for property management, which is, you know, they're going to get paid, you know, 10 to 15% on jobs they have to do. And we took that to mean construction, right? So like if we are adding on something big, they get 10 to 15%.
Sure.
The way that they were interpreting it was every call out, every
Day-to-day
maintenance run,
management. Yeah.
everything,
Wow.
15%. You answer the phone, 15%. Your call
Wow.
out fee plus 15%. Your fee plus 15, right? And it was like,
Right.
wow. And so we didn't realize the impact of that until probably about 6 months in to having this new property manager. And we were just looking at our entire margin going out the door to them.
Wow.
Right. And so we basically ended up at this situation where the deal wasn't cash flowing. We couldn't increase rents, you know, to offset what was happening. The market was going soft around us.
Right.
And we actually ended up getting the loan from the bank out of a distressed asset situation because the previous owners had owned it during COVID and they were basically on forbearance, you know, due to the just the real estate market during COVID going completely upside down, right? People couldn't be evicted, nobody paid.
Right.
And so we ended up with an asset that was barely cash flowing, more often than not in the red. And after a capital call to try to turn it around, we all just sat down and said, look, this thing is not turning around. We got to sell. And we all took a hit. You know, we all took a hit. I took a pretty big hit as the main key partner, as the main GP, as the guy who was kind of leading the charge to get this deal to happen. You know, I really put my own money on the line instead of my partners, right? And really tried to cover them as much as I could. So, you know, they wouldn't
How
lose
much
as
did you
much.
lose, if you don't mind me
Yeah,
asking?
that one I lost about $600,000 on that one.
Wow, that
Yep.
stings.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And again, the range is kind of, well, what do you consider losing it? You know, I over the course of the years, right? Put in money that I'm not getting back. And yeah, it does sting.
Right.
But at the same time, I look at the partners in the deal, and while we all lost money, you know, they walked out with more of a shirt than I had. And I think that, you know, if you're going to invest in real estate, what you want to see is a story like that. You know, when did you as the lead take the hit to protect everyone else? Right. And if they can't point to it, you're investing with somebody who doesn't have enough money to do that. And that's a scary place to be because they're going to cut and run. Right.
That's amazing. So on that point, just for an investor, maybe whether LP, GP, but what's the advice you would give someone about that? You're saying if the key KP doesn't have enough money, you shouldn't partner with them, or what exactly is the advice there?
So when you look at the way a real estate deal comes together, someone has to have money in the deal. The bank wants to see that someone has enough money or net worth to cover the loan that they're going to give to the syndication, to the group. So that means that someone somewhere in the deal has money. And what you want to make sure of is that you are somewhere between the bank and that person with money. And that's not always the case. So one deal that I was looking at, I happen to know some of the key partners. I knew one of the key partners who was signing didn't have a giant balance sheet, but had the operational experience, and they were going to be the operator. And the key partner who was signing, who had the giant balance sheet, I knew was not going to be a primary operator, right? And so what that meant was when things went, or if things went south, right, the operator didn't have their own skin in the game, and they were more than likely to sell at a loss and basically toss the syndication group aside to protect their other key partner who actually had the balance sheet, right? Because
Okay, that makes a
somebody's
lot
got
of
to pay the
sense.
bank back, right? And when you have equity in a deal, if you sell for the value of the loan, you are probably going to sell for less than the asset is worth. And so somebody takes a hit, and that somebody is the investor group, right? Now,
That
the way
makes
you want
sense.
it to be is somebody takes a hit, that somebody's the person with the biggest balance sheet, right? If you're investing with an established GP, they can throw their balance sheet in front of the investors and take the first hit. So people walk away with some of their money, right? And that's a GP who values their investor base because they want to come back to you for the next deal and the deal after that,
It's a longer
right?
term view versus
Exactly. But
relationship, long term, absolutely.
what you'll see with a lot of the newer GPs that implode is they're, you know, signing these deals and they don't have the balance sheet to protect their investors. And so when a deal goes south, they just sell the asset for what they can, pay off the loan, and they don't care that their investors lost money,
Got
right?
it.
And so that's where you don't want to be as an LP, because you are the person who gets tossed in the fire, and that's not where you want to be as an investor.
So let's pivot a little bit, and I mean, I know we briefly touched on your book. So what is it about real estate that sucks? I mean, we talked about your personal experiences and some of the things that went really poorly, but what is it that you don't like about real estate? And I understand there are things good about real estate. I put out content about why you should not invest in mortgage notes, and I do mortgage notes, full time. So there's no perfect asset class, and there I think we did a blog post that was 10 reasons not to invest in mortgage notes. And what is it about real estate that sucks? And what are some other maybe more controversial views that you might have in the personal finance or investing space?
So one of the things that I highlight in my book is basically, you know, outside of losing money, there's operational stuff that people don't necessarily see covered in these other real estate investing books. One of the big ones is when you join a syndication, you get a K-1. Most people don't realize that a K-1 is technically due in March, which is before your taxes are due. However,
March 15th.
many small syndications will not get you a K-1 on time. And so you are signing up for extending your tax returns for every year that you are in the partnership, because you cannot get out of the partnership. And if you've got a partnership that is perpetually late on K-1s, like
Which is very
I have,
common.
I have enough partnerships that one of them is always late. You extend your taxes, right? You extend when you get your return in. And the thing is, your taxes are still due April 15th, even if your return is not complete, even if you're filing for an extension, right? And so you end up in this position where your tax life basically is never done on April 15th. And that is just something that for me, I don't like, because then I get billed more by my CPA for extending, and then, you know,
Absolutely.
You can't close out the previous year mentally
It's
until like
crazy.
September sometimes.
Yeah, and it was April 15th. I'm almost certain years ago it was actually April 15th that the K-1s were due, and a lot of people, syndications and funds were late still. And regardless, like by April 15th, you could not file your taxes, but you had to pay your taxes, like you're saying. So I'm in that position now, actually. I mean, a lot of it is very common for K-1s not to be put out on time. I can say we've, with our fund, every year put out our K-1s on time, which is good. But that is something that sucks about real estate. I would agree with that for sure. What else?
It's something I see a lot of, like doctors especially try to get into real estate because I think it's going to be massive. And when you're a doctor, you're already busy enough,
For
and now you
sure.
got a K-1 that's going to show up in August, right? It's like, hey, guess what? Your taxes got to get reopened because you never finished that, right? And so it's just the mental headspace of like, and no passive real estate investment is ever passive. If you're an LP, technically, legally, it's supposed to be passive. But the minute you start buying passive real estate, like you buy a single family home and you're like, oh, it's going to be passive. It's not passive. Right. And I tell you that as somebody who owned passive real estate and I was up on the roof of my passive real estate, right? Like you, if you are on the roof of your real estate investment, that is
That's
not
not
passive.
passive. No, I would agree. I mean, and don't want to get sidetracked. I've done we put out some content about, I think last year for the Cash Flow Expo, I did a thing about presentation about kind of the spectrum of passiveness. And I would say our fund for we invest in first lien mortgage notes. We do monthly distributions. It's about as passive as you can get. I mean, ultimately, it's like I want to check and make sure my deposit occurred, and where's my K-1? And some people are a little more hands-on than others, some of our investors. That's about as passive as you can get in this space from my standpoint. But there's a huge spectrum in between, and there are a lot of ways, whether it's through joint ventures, selling partials, doing hypothecations, buying, I mean, buying a couple of performing loans it's not super active, but gurus love in our space to say active and passive, or performing and non-performing. And it's like there's a huge gray area that's really the majority of experiences in reality. And so I would agree in most, and there's you can get pretty close to passive, and then there's the other extreme of really active and managing a fund and things like that. So yeah, I mean, what a lot of people are sold is not the reality. I would agree with that for sure. So, I mean, I was really into listening to Bigger Pockets and reading the books as well. And owning a bunch of re single family rental properties is very far from passive, even if you have a good property manager. I mean, that's not passive investing at all. It may
No,
be
it is
treated
not.
that way from a tax standpoint, but it's not passive. So, so the 100% agree. So what would you say is passive? I guess, would you say investing in stocks and crypto is passive, or are there passive asset classes out there?
Yeah. So the way that we run our wealth management practice here is we try to be as hands-on as we can so our clients can live their lives. Right. And that's kind of when you look at passive investing, I truly believe that you should never be a complete passive investor, right? You should always know what you're buying. You should know why you're buying it. You should know what it does for your portfolio. Now, you outsource a lot of the thinking oftentimes to professionals, right? For instance, you know why you have real estate in your portfolio. I can tell you what percent of your portfolio is at real estate, what your value at risk is, what that does, right? To your portfolio in various, market scenarios. Like that's my job, right? My job is to go through all that nitty-gritty stuff and kind of say, okay, well, here's what you got and here's how it ebbs and flows, right? But if you just go, look, I've got the stocks and I've got these bonds and I've got this real estate and I know roughly why each of them helps me go to Disney World every year. That's what you need to know, right? That's what you need to know. Or I know why I'm investing in this portfolio because it's going to get me another $1 million. That is what you should know, and you should have an understanding of why you're building the portfolio the way you are. But then really hiring professionals to manage those investments, I think, is the right move because someone has to look at your portfolio every day. Someone has to understand
Yeah.
what the jobs report means for your holdings. And if that's
Right.
you and you've got a day job, that means you're spending your weekend reviewing economic data. And
Right.
while that's fun for me, because this is my job, I can almost guarantee you that most of my clients would rather spend that time with their family or,
Yeah.
you know, out exercising or out on the lake. And
Sure.
really what you're buying at that point is, you know, you're buying your weekend and
Right,
you're paying a professional so you don't have to do it yourself.
makes a lot of sense. So we are starting to run out of time here. So do you is there any kind of general guidance for, you know, a percent of someone's portfolio that they should have real estate, or is that completely client specific?
So I will say it's usually very client specific as to
Yeah.
what your risk capacity is
Yeah.
and your risk profile is. You know, I
Sure.
think Jamie, you and I talked about this earlier before we started recording, which is, you know, your investor persona, right?
Right.
Your investor profile. And that
Absolutely.
is one of the biggest things. You know, for me, when I look at that deal that I did in real estate,
Yeah.
we lost money because we were not dealing with really tenants and an environment that I was used to dealing with.
Right.
I don't invest in mobile home parks because, quite frankly, I don't have anything in common with folks in mobile home parks. And that is not, you know, I deal with folks who are generally college educated with advanced degrees. I just
Yeah.
don't know how to deal with the tenants in
Yeah.
mobile home parks. And as a result of that, I don't know how to evaluate the deal. I don't know how to get involved in that. And so I
Yeah.
just don't put my money there.
Right. No,
Right.
and it's not that you're putting those people down or something. It's just that you're understanding your own investor avatar and your own self. Know thyself, right? And
Exactly.
second time I've referred to this Cash Flow Expo, but a couple months ago I did a presentation about knowing your investor avatar first instead of just jumping into an asset class that somebody else is doing and it looks sexy. I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's so critical. And I've made that mistake myself, is not really understanding who I am from an investor standpoint and what I'm trying to accomplish. I'm more focused on this sexy deal, and oftentimes that doesn't go well. So
Yeah.
makes sense. Yeah. What's one other kind of maybe, you know, key piece of guidance that you give your clients, if you would? Is there any kind of framework that fits to for everyone, or is everything client specific?
Yeah. Let's kind of just paint some broad strokes on advice that I give folks.
Yeah.
So the first one of them is kind of risk capacity and risk tolerance.
Okay.
These are two separate things. Most of the time we talk about risk tolerance, right?
Mm-hmm.
If this investment goes up 10% or down 20%, which one would you rather have? Okay. That's very different from risk capacity. Risk
Yeah.
capacity is how much of a hit can your balance sheet take in dollar terms
Okay.
before there's a problem,
Okay.
right? If you're worth $100 million, your risk capacity is probably in the millions. You can probably lose $10 million in a single year and not care. Now, your risk tolerance may be very different, right? You may be one of those people that you worked your entire life for that $100 million. And
Yeah.
this is it. This is, you have now made it. You have dynastic wealth for your family. That is what you wanted. Losing
Right.
$1 million would be catastrophic to you mentally. So
So,
even though you can lose 10 million,
yeah.
right? If you don't deal with someone who recognizes the two together, you might
Interesting.
end up in a situation where your financial advisor is saying, well, you're fine. And you're going, no, but I'm staying up at night.
Yeah. So,
Conversely,
risk
yeah.
tolerance is a little more emotional slash, you know, individually, you know, mentally specific, if that makes sense. Risk capacity is a little more objective, logical from a third party standpoint. Is that fair?
Exactly. Yeah. And you'll
Okay.
see this in real estate all the time for people
Yeah.
who are growing their empire. Your risk tolerance is high. You are willing to take wipeout risk. Your risk
Right.
capacity is very low because you have to put food on the table for your family.
Right. That's a great point. I hadn't really thought of it like that. I like that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, before we hit some rapid fire questions, any other kind of general guidance that you like to give people?
Yeah, start early. Whatever you're going to do, whatever you're doing for investing, get started early, even if it's not perfect. Because if you look at a 30-year investing horizon, the last 3 years grow your money more than the first 10 years combined
Wow.
in many cases. Yep. So just get started. Doesn't matter what it is,
Absolutely.
just get going.
All right. So I have a few questions I ask almost every guest, but one more before we get to those. You're a tech slash, you know, finance slash, you know, investing guy. So where do you see AI How is that going to disrupt our entire our environment from a career standpoint, investing standpoint? Nobody knows 100%. We know that. But what's your best guess as to are accountants going to be a thing in 3 years? Are attorneys out of business? What are things going to look like in a couple of years from an because of AI?
Yes, I think the basics are going to be covered by AI very easily. In my own profession, I have talked to AI about things that are complex, like Roth conversions. AI has gotten Roth conversions wrong. So if you're about to move $100,000 in a Roth conversion and take a tax bill, come talk to me because I tried to do this with AI and AI was like, oh yeah, no, these are equivalent. I'm like, well, you forgot to pay taxes. It's like, oh yeah, you're right. I totally forgot to pay taxes. It's like, well, okay, that's why you talk to an expert,
But
right?
it
So the
never
easy
fully
stuff.
admits its mistakes. That's the thing that gets me. But
Oh
anyway.
yeah, exactly. You're exactly right. I totally missed that. It's like, well,
Yeah.
but great, but I want a little bit more contrition out of you.
Yes.
Yes. So for complex stuff, the expert is still the best way to go.
Sure.
Especially things where you may end up on a litigation docket, because at the end of the day, AI is still not in the courts. And court cases are basically humans talking about opinions and deciding which one is right. And that's where you want a human to be involved because a computer doesn't understand opinions and shades of being correct. At the same time, if you are not using AI yet in your own practice and your own job, whatever that is, get on it. It is huge. It allows me to punch well above my weight as a small firm. I can do the work of a probably, 20-person marketing department with one AI chat. That's amazing, right? So
Absolutely.
that's is a huge tool. It's a huge
Yeah.
tool.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. Like everything or most things, there are pros and cons, and so makes a lot of
Exactly.
sense. Some rapid fire questions for you.
Let's do it.
You've already touched on this, but briefly, how has financial abundance made your life better?
I don't have to sweat the small stuff and I get to think big, right? I have the resources where if I see something in my community that I want to change, I actually have the connections and the balance sheet to go be the person to change it. I can't change everything, but if I care enough, I can be the guy leading the charge. And that's a really cool thing to do.
That is really cool. That's really good. What is a book or two that you can recommend for my listener?
Ooh, that's good. All right. I will actually take one of these books on my shelf here. It's called The First Tycoon. It's about Cornelius Vanderbilt. I've recommended this book before. I think there's a lot of knowledge to be gained by studying the origin stories of wealthy individuals. Cornelius Vanderbilt was one of the first very wealthy individuals. Same thing, you can go with Andrew Carnegie or Rockefeller. But really, in those books, when you read them, read the first few chapters very, very thoroughly, because what you want to learn is how they do their first deal. It's not about the deal at the end that they made when they were 50, 60, 80, right? That's where
Right.
you're going to get. But how you get there is that first deal. And that's what I recommend people read those
Yeah.
origin stories. Find that first deal. Find how they start.
Makes sense. Yeah, I've heard I mean we all like to quote Warren Buffett these days, but what he's doing now is pretty different from what he was doing 30, 40 years ago. So, what's one question that you wish I'd asked that I did not ask?
Ooh, that's good. What's my investing philosophy?
What is your investing
Because
philosophy, Dr. Adam Link?
yes. So this is something that my clients and I talk about all the time, is philosophical fit with your financial advisor. I believe that you can look at markets and you can navigate through public stock markets. A lot of people call this active risk management. A lot of people confuse it with active management, but basically what we are doing is we are taking positions in the market and we are not just buying index funds and holding for 30 years. We truly believe that you can better position your portfolio based on macroeconomic factors. And that is something that a lot of people in the financial advising industry say, well, you don't outperform the market when you do that.
You hear that all the
And
time.
that is 100% right. I'm not trying to outperform the market. I'm trying to do a little bit better than the market does when we lose money. And I'm trying to get as much of the upside as I can when the market makes money. And what that looks like is a smoother ride for my clients, where you don't lose as much, you may not gain as much, right? But that's really what we're looking for is stop stressing out our clients.
So a little less volatility, right? Sounds like.
Exactly.
Got it. Awesome. Well, Dr. Adam Link, where can our listeners find you online?
Yes, you can go to fireweedcapital.com. That is our online website. You can also email me directly, adam@fireweedcapital.com. I love to talk finance, real estate, tech, and obviously if you set up a time to chat with me, the first meeting is always free. Usually the first couple of meetings, we're just getting to know each other, see if it's a good fit. So if that sounds like something, you know, your listeners want to do, by all means,
awesome.
They can reach out.
And your typical client avatar, you already touched on this, but just reiterate, who do you often work with?
Yeah, so I often work with tech families. I've got a family, so I work very well with parents. And the biggest thing that I love is I love clients who are striving to become more. If you've got $10,000 and you want to be worth $10 million, Let's talk. I mean, that's awesome. I love getting on phone calls with people who are striving to better themselves and better their financial situation, because I get jazzed up by that.
Absolutely.
And I love to help people.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that's one of the things I love about this, my podcast, honestly, is that it fires me up. And we talk about taking ownership of your financial situation, your health and different things, just taking ownership of your situation. I do some mentorship in mortgage note investing, and the people I end up loving, you know, to work with are those who take ownership and they're fired up and they want to, because it's up to you, you know, it's not up to me to do the work. And so I hear what you're saying there. So that's great. Didn't mean to take it back about me, but, Adam, this has been really, really great. I feel like we should have you on again. That you clearly are a wealth of knowledge. You've, you know, done really well for sure, but that you've had your share of, cuts and bruises and challenges along the way. So any final thoughts that you want to share with our listeners?
Yeah, there is no end to having enough money. And so you got to decide where enough is. For me, I want another zero. I'm not done yet. I want to keep growing. So
awesome.
Reach out, and I want to grow alongside those that want to grow.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Likewise, Jamie. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And to the listener, thank you for spending your most valuable resource with us. And that is your time. Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Thank you for joining us on From Adversity to Abundance. We hope today's episode has equipped you with valuable insights and practical advice to elevate your real estate journey. For more inspiring stories and resources, visit us at www.adversitytoabundance.com. If this episode has inspired you, please share it with a friend who could also benefit from our conversation. Together, let's turn adversity into abundance. Until next time, keep building your mental fitness and your real estate empire.
All right, here's the deal. You work hard for your money. Isn't it about time you put your money to work for you? If you are an accredited investor, check out LabradorLending.com. Our Integrity Income Fund provides monthly cash flow from an investment backed by hard physical real estate. Our income fund, which is uncorrelated to publicly traded stocks and bonds, invests in first lien mortgage notes diversified by geography, property value, and borrower type. So you're not investing in one project. You're investing in a diversified portfolio of first lien mortgage notes. Our Integrity Income Fund aims to pay its investors monthly distributions at a preferred rate of return of 8% annually. Possibly the best part, though, the fund showcases a short 12-month commitment. So you can invest your capital today and have access to that capital in 1 year. Check it out today, LabradorLending.com.